Hey, 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 guys. Welcome to Building This Community.
This is your city business and policy development podcast. We're your hosts,
Luke Patrick
and Andrew Klump. Welcome to this week's episode of Building This Community. Our guests today are Melissa and Chris Bruntlett, who are the co-founders of Medacity and co-authors of Building the Cycling City, the Dutch Blueprint for Urban Vitality, who now have a new book called Curbing Traffic, The Human Case for Fewer Cars in Our Lives. Melissa, Chris, how are you?
I think we're doing pretty well, thanks. How are you guys?
Doing well. Thank you guys so much for joining us. I know we did an interview a few months ago about your previous book, and we're very excited to have you on this time. Just before we kind of delve into your new book, can you just kind of give us an update? Tell us a little bit about your background and kind of the current state of your careers.
Yeah, well, I think we spoke in December of 2020. We had just delivered the manuscript on this book, having never promised to write a second book. But this is the follow-up to Building the Cycling City, which we wrote after a kind of life-changing visit to the Netherlands in 2016. We were working as bike advocates in Vancouver at the time, and wanted to share this story, not just of the Netherlands, but how the Netherlands could inspire the world to build more cycle-friendly streets. And that book took us on a tour around the world. It landed us jobs working in the Netherlands for Dutch organizations, myself for the Dutch Cycling Embassy and Melissa for Mobicon. And we are talking to you today, you know, as 2.5 year residents of Delft in the Netherlands. And this book is coming out in about a week or so, and we're quite excited to put it out in the world.
Yeah, that's tremendous, guys. What can you tell us? What kind of preview can you give us about your all's new book?
Yeah, so the first book really focused on what or how cities can become more cycling friendly, what steps the Dutch took and what cities other places are taking to achieve those steps. And then after living here for about a year, Chris and I found ourselves really reveling in a lot of the quality of life changes that we expected, but didn't expect at the scale in which we were enjoying them. And so book number two is really more about the why. It's imperative to really design our cities to be less focused around cars. So we often come back to this book is not about bikes. Not, there are bikes in it, obviously, but it's not just about bikes, but rather the reason, the case for having cities that work for people in more human-powered modes and allowing for less space for cars.
Essentially, this book is more about the why and less about the how. What can people kind of look forward to with this book?
We wanted to write for two audiences. The first was, and maybe not as important, was Dutch people that were constantly asking us why we would leave Vancouver, Canada to come to the Netherlands. And we constantly found ourselves explaining this quality of life to them that they take for granted and are completely blind to. But obviously more important is the rest of the world that doesn't get to come and visit the Netherlands, to help them understand what it is about Dutch cities that is so special, and why they can achieve and how they can achieve that, and why it is so important in their own context. So I think we're so caught in the fights around housing, around transportation, public transportation, around cycle lanes, that we don't have to stop to appreciate why we're fighting these battles. And it goes far beyond the usual kind of discussions around climate change or public health. We wanted to really dig deeper and look at what car dependence and car dominance does to us in terms of our mental health, in terms of our social connections and our social trust. And also, you know, what it's doing to those people in our society that don't have the privilege of owning and operating a car. And we're talking about nearly 50% of the population, be it children, the elderly, people with physical disabilities, low-income residents. These are all people that enjoy, I think, and we think, a much higher quality of life here in the Netherlands because the transportation networks and the street designs are much more inclusive, and they allow them to participate in society even though they don't have access to a car.
You guys earlier said that you kind of were able to do this whirlwind tour, kind of advocating for cycling and being really ambassadors for a more walkable or cycling centric city design. At what point after your first book did you know you were going to set out and write another?
I think, so full disclosure, Chris took a little bit of, convincing. Chris had to spend some time convincing me because I was just busy enjoying living in the Netherlands for the first little bit. But I think it was probably about 9 months after, after moving here, you know, we're talking about the improvements to our quality of life, to our own mental health, and we're watching our children thrive in this environment that allows them freedom of mobility out of the watchful eye of their parents. And, you know, we started to think, you know, these are things that really we should be sharing. We do that quite actively on social media, but thinking about the larger implications, there's only so much you can communicate through social media. And so this book became the opportunity for us to really dig into the research about what it means to have valuable social connections, not just with your family or close friends, but with the people in your neighborhood. What it means for women in terms of more equitable streets, what does that do in terms of changing their quality of life? And even getting into, you know, the elderly, you know, what does it mean when cities are places where they can stay in place as they, or age in place as they get older and are no longer able to drive? You know, what does that mean at a more deeper level in terms of us as human beings and as we, you know, as a society?
Well, and you mentioned in particular the role of women. How does, and you talk about this in your book, how does, you know, cycling or accessible city design, how does that incorporate and embrace feminism?
That's an excellent question. and I think what happens is a lot of times in urban planning and transportation planning, there's so much focus, and there has been for nearly a century, on the economic benefits of what you're doing. Are we getting people to and from work faster? Are we allowing for the economic vitality of our cities? But what that does is it tends to focus on only one trip that people take in terms of that trip to and from work, or if we're talking about, you know, logistics, how are we facilitating those? But we're not talking about all of the other trips that people take in a day, specifically when it comes to women care trips. So, you know, although the the load of trips are being shared more and more between two partners, be they same-sex or not same-sex couples, still women predominantly do a lot of those care trips, like getting kids to and from school, running errands like doing groceries, taking care of elderly families. And when you make a city or a transportation network itself much more malleable and allowing for multiple stops or trip chaining, or getting people to the destinations they actually want to get to, as opposed to creating networks that keep them away from those destinations in order to facilitate fast commuting routes, it becomes inequitable. It doesn't take into account the experience of women in the city and where they need to go.
I could definitely see that. Another part that stood out early on in your all's work, it was a line that I just couldn't get over. Children and cars are competitors. Can you maybe explain what you all meant by that?
Yeah, this was said to us by Dr. Leah Karsten, who's an academic at the University of Amsterdam, who's done some really pioneering research on this topic. And she directly charts the removal of the child from the street and the loss of on-street play to the rise of the automobile on our streets, whether it's for movement through the street or parking on the curb. And so we need to really have a serious look at ourselves as a society, having robbed our children of a place, a safe and comfortable place to play in the eyes of their neighbors out on the street in the public space. And we've now reduced them to very limited opportunities for social and physical activity, whether it's in their back garden, in the playground, or supervised at a community center or a gymnasium. And so Dr. Karsten now basically depressingly categorizes most children in the 21st century as either belonging to the indoor generation or the backseat generation. So they're either stuck in their house with nowhere to go. These are usually children of lower economic means. But the backseat generation maybe has a bit more means because they're being shuttled everywhere by their parents. So in order just to get to the corner store, to get to daycare or school, to get anywhere they need, they suddenly require their parents to shuttle them from A to B. And this has all kinds of damaging effects on them developmentally. They are no longer obviously physically and socially active, but they're not able to know their neighborhoods and their neighbors. They aren't able to calculate and take risks. And this is now, you know, filtering up into generations of children that are, well, referred to as the bubble wrap generation. And it obviously is very complex culturally with all these contributing factors, but we have to look at the rise of automobile traffic on our streets as a major contributing factor to that.
So I guess, does that mean that the argument kind of goes a more bike-friendly or walkable city is going to necessarily foster a greater trust between parents and their children if the kids are able to get out of the house more like that, more independently?
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is that, you know, as parents, all we want is for our kids to be safe and taken care of. And so when we look out on the street, if we see a traffic calm neighborhood where there's a few cars moving through, but they move at a slow speed, they acknowledge the space that they're sharing with other road users, it creates a much safer environment. And so as parents, we'll be much more willing at an earlier age to allow our children to explore outside of our eyesight. So here in the Netherlands, most children by the age of 8 start taking some trips to school by themselves. And by the time they're 10, 11, 12, they're fully doing that independently of their parents. And inversely, when we were living in Canada, our experience was very much the opposite in that we saw a lot of cars racing through our neighborhood, very little regard for who else was crossing at an intersection or, you know, children just playing in the neighborhood. And so we ourselves being, you know, just a little more liberal, we found ourselves in much ways the only parents that were allowing our kids to experience that, which would create a very isolating experience for our kids. So in accordance, we would become quite nervous about letting them, trusting them to go and, you know, explore our neighborhood on their own. Not because, for example, in that case, that we didn't trust them, but that we were worried about there not being that community out there looking out for them as well. They were very literally on their own in a lot of cases.
Well, and we see, I see at least on Twitter, a lot of people locally in Louisville that post pictures of, you know, kids standing in front of these giant vehicles, and they always have those kind of advocacies of, you know, you can't see what's in front of you and it makes it more dangerous. But the one thing I don't see is the discussion on the impact on hearing. And I know that's one of the chapters of your book is talking about the hearing city. What does that mean? And why is that so important?
Yeah, this was something we observe every time we came to the Netherlands and still continue to observe every time we now travel overseas and come back to the Netherlands. The moment you step outside a Dutch train station, whether it's Amsterdam Central or Delft Station or Rotterdam Central, you're immediately hit with this sensation of calm, peacefulness, and you notice sounds that you probably wouldn't hear elsewhere in the world. We're talking about birds chirping, people having conversations, squeaking bicycles, church bells, and the like. And it really adds to the experience of being in the city, but it also provides this this therapeutic quality that we delve into a little bit. But inversely, it really got us thinking, why noise pollution is, well, we know why it's so prevalent. It's almost 2/3 of it comes from the cars that we drive. But what impact is that having us on human beings? Because it barely registers when we've been immersed in it for a while. We adapt to it really, really quickly and easily as humans, because it's what researchers refer to as an ambient stress. But that ambient stress is taking its toll, and we dug into studies that connected it to cardiovascular disease, loss of sleep, all kinds of physical and mental illnesses that are, you know, doing untold damage to the people that live in cities simply because we prioritize motor vehicle traffic over the people that live along those streets. And so One thing that the Netherlands deserves a lot of credit for is in 1979, they passed a Noise Abatement Act, a national noise pollution law that limits the maximum decibel levels along certain corridors, depending on the building type and as measured from inside the building. And so you're rarely in anywhere in the Netherlands where you are overwhelmed by the noise. Because they've taken this seriously as a policy issue, and they've been given the teeth to implement a meaningful piece of legislation. And as far as we know, it's one of the only few pieces of legislation in the world that's actually enforced and has made a difference in terms of the decibel levels within cities. So I think you have to experience it yourself. You know, we try to post videos and audio clips of what it's like being in a city where you can suddenly hear again. But you really have to come here to experience it for yourself. And we would invite people to do so if they so have the opportunity.
I think I was just adding on to that, the one of a very few number of bright sides that came through the pandemic was, you know, as we're writing this chapter on hearing and the impacts that the sounds our cities make has on us, everyone around the world is suddenly experiencing their cities very much how we experience it on a day-to-day basis pre-pandemic as well. So, you know, as people started working from home and only necessary trips were made in terms of car travel or public transport, the cities got quieter. We remember stories of people hearing birdsong in New York City, in Manhattan of all places, like, you know, people started to experience that. So it is something that we hope that people hold on to as we return to a more new normal way of life. But yeah, that ability to hear your city can't be undervalued, I think, but hear it in a positive way, the positive sounds of our city.
Yeah. So when advocating for change to kind of create lower decibel in the city, as far as noise pollution goes, do you have an all in, all or nothing, or more of a measured approach that you think would be important? So, for example, I see a lot of cycling advocates here locally push for speed bumps, but those also create more noise pollution when cars go over them. Do you think this is more of just we need to design streets to reduce the total number of cars, or are there measured steps that we can take to reduce noise in a gradual phase?
In that chapter, we do kind of spell out a series of effective measures through the research that we've done. And they start with, yes, reducing the speed and volume of cars, because that is the most cost-effective and effective way to do it. And then it filters down to quieter tires, more vegetation and trees to absorb the sound. And then, you know, last at the bottom of the list is kind of sound barriers, and because they are a very expensive way to address this issue. So it's obviously not a one size fits all solution. It's choosing what works for that particular area. But simply by starting this conversation, I think you will find that it's an issue that most people are affected by. Most people are quite passionate about. And we found that every time we post about it on social media, people get really kind of and they're quite enlightened and have an opinion, and they say it's an issue that they deal with in their daily lives, and they feel quite powerless to stop it. And this is where we need leadership at the governmental level to actually put policies in place to start dealing with this issue. Because as we point out in the book, we talk about air pollution plenty, and we talk about water pollution plenty, but we rarely, if ever, talk about noise pollution. And it's actually one of the pollutants that affects more humans than any other on Earth.
It's almost tough to imagine like a major thriving downtown area that isn't completely replete with cars and the noise associated with like modern traffic. I think it'd be a really interesting thing to see firsthand. And especially like my family, we've got a farm in Franklin County. It's definitely a more rural part of the state. And it is one of the things that I notice when I'm able to get out there as compared to my kind of downtown house here in Louisville. It feels just serene to be able to walk around and not feel like there's constantly somebody bearing down on you with a car or something like that. But moving beyond the noise pollution, are there other elements of a cycling focused city that might make them more accessible, especially for people that are maybe dealing with a disability?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we come back to this a lot throughout the book, this theme of traffic calming, but it can't be undervalued or it has to be, you know, a central part of the conversation, not just for making things safer for kids or, you know, reducing the number of cars, but also the effect that has on the accessibility of people of the city. And so it comes in multiple ways. So first is, you know, when we're thinking about how people traverse a street, for example, when you're trying to reduce or have fewer cars in the city, or you create an environment where the interactions are much more comfortable between these groups, then the ability to get out on their own becomes much more of a reality. They know, for example, someone in a scootmobile or a wheelchair, if they're going to cross the street, they know that the cars clearly will be able to see them, that they have refuge, that there's space for them to get by and enough time for them to get by. And, you know, that really impacts their ability to actually take that trip in the first place, because oftentimes when you have these really hostile environments, people that are already dealing with a disability and the stress that goes along with that are not going to readily go out if they know they're going to be more uncomfortable and more stressed. And then at the same time, these traffic calming environments become a place where the street opens up to them. So when we are traveling around here in the Netherlands, oftentimes you'll see somebody with an adaptive cycle or with a scootmobile using the cycling infrastructure to get around. Even we've seen women and men using walkers to get around that will use the cycling infrastructure because it's smooth, it's wide, it's protected, and they feel comfortable enough to travel along there. And everyone moving around them gives them the respect that they need, because we understand that this is a space that we all have to share and that these individuals have just as much right to the city as we do. It comes down to, like I said, making sure that they can actually take these trips, because oftentimes we find that we're pitting people against or cycle lanes are pitted against the accessibility of our city. We've heard arguments from North America that when you take away the ability to drive, you take away the ability for those living with disabilities to access the city. But that completely ignores the fact that these people don't necessarily want to rely on others to get around. And most people living with a disability probably can't drive themselves without putting an immense expense into adapting their personal vehicle. So when we say accessibility and car access go hand in hand, we are completely ignoring what these individuals actually want, what they need. And we're making it so they have to be dependent on others to experience the city. And, you know, we're all, as individuals, as children, as elderly, as people with able-bodied people or people living with disabilities, we all want to have control over how we experience the city and how we move through it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think the accessibility we hit on this show all the time, that it is so crucial for equity, for a good quality of life, for a variety of reasons. But how does that translate into the prosperous city? You know, what you mentioned that in chapter 8, is that simply just a reference to, you know, car ownership on the individual, or are there other areas that reducing cars can create more prosperity?
Yeah, there's actually an interesting trend here in the Netherlands to use the word accessibility, which is a bereikbaar, in the transportation field. So when we're talking about trams, trains, buses, bicycles, we're actually planning and building networks that provide people with accessibility to affordable housing, accessibility to healthcare, accessibility to well-paying jobs, accessibility to everything they need in their day-to-day lives. This is more than just a means of to get from A to B. This is a means to help them live their lives and fulfill their economic potential. So we spend a chapter talking about what a prosperous city looks like in terms of allowing everybody the same access to opportunity without having to own and operate a piece of machinery that at last count costs over $12,000 per year to own or operate. For low-income residents in particular, who may be making $20,000 to $50,000, that is, you know, a significant chunk of their take-home pay just gone to their means of transport. So if we make these collective investments as a society here in the Netherlands, the cycling networks and the public transportation networks work really well to complement each other. we are giving those people the same access to opportunity as people that have the privilege of living near a train station, living near a city center, living near the economic hubs. The people that maybe live out in the less well-to-do areas have the same access to those areas. They're able to take jobs that will pay them without worrying about how they're going to get to and from that job. And they're not handing out a significant portion of their paycheck to pay for their transportation. And that leaves them more money to spend on their families, invest in their communities, and create a more economically prosperous and economically resilient place moving forward. So this was all about dollars and cents or euros and cents for us. And to me and to us, the idea that you need to own a car, maybe multiple cars if you're in a family, just to go to school or go to work is really holding us back in a lot of parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, anything that can keep some extra dollars and cents in our pocket, I think is fine by me. But moving on to another topic that Andrew and I have covered several times at this point, Louisville is starting to see its population age at a rate, you know, greater than the national average. In fact, the term we heard recently that I kind of fell in love with, people are calling it a silver tsunami. So how does cycling play a role in an aging city?
Well, really, you know, what we see, what we experience is that when we have created these environments where walking and cycling is really easy, regardless of your age. So, you know, 880 Cities has a great goal of making sure that anyone that's 8 years old or 80 years old can experience the same quality of life in the city. That's what a city that makes walking and cycling viable, safe, and comfortable is achieving. And what it comes down to is it's not necessarily cycling, but it's all the ways that people can move when they are no longer able to drive. So at any point in our lives, we're going to reach a point, whether it's through physical injury or through aging, where we can't drive anymore. And by creating an environment where going out for a walk or going out for a bike ride becomes easy and comfortable, we are allowing people the ability to stay in their homes for longer, to experience the city and be a part of society for longer into their silver years, as we'll put it. It really allows them to feel like they're not being shunned away or hidden away now that they're older and now they're stuck in their homes. So when we really look at making sure that that space for them or for any of us as we get older is, again, accessible and is comfortable to experience outside of a car, then we allow, no matter how old you get, people to age in place. And of course, the e-bike takes that to the next level in terms of extending the ability for people to stay active, stay mobile for longer into their years.
Yeah, and we just actually had the CEO of the Louisville Healthcare CEO Council on, and she talked about, you know, the importance of people being involved in their community so that you know why did someone miss their appointment? Was it because they didn't have access, or is it because they, you know, have some sort of loneliness or depression or issue that because they're, you know, in their home? And I think this just all kind of plays the same role, not same, but they all intertwine a little bit because you have to have that accessibility. The more you see people get out, the better the healthcare services will be, the better, you know, the as Chris mentioned earlier, the prosperity will be. So I think that is an incredibly important point that you just made. But we are starting to wrap up here. And so I do want to thank you all for coming on, but we have two final questions. We know you have your new book coming out now, which is The Curbing Traffic, The Human Case for Fewer Cars in Our Lives. Do you have anything else that you'd like to promote, any other projects or more information you want to give people about your new book?
well, we are hosting a little launch event if anyone's interested on the 29th when the book officially comes out. And you can get information for that from our website. But otherwise, as always, keep following along. We're always discovering new things, new projects, new developments in and around the Netherlands, and we're always happy to share and hopefully provide inspiration. And that's a lot of what Chris does in his day-to-day job, of course, is really exporting what people are doing here across various organizations to really promote cycling and livability and help bring that to other countries.
Yeah, so if I could just plug the Dutch Cycling Embassy for a minute, and this is the immense privilege that I have in my day job, is we are, as an organization, exist specifically to export the knowledge and expertise that exists here in the Netherlands. So if you're a municipal government worker, a transport planner, an engineer who's looking to learn from the Netherlands, just get in touch, dutchcycling.nl. We do webinars, workshops, study tours. We talk to politicians, planners, and help them understand why this is important, of course, but also how learning from the decades of trial and error that's taken place in this country. And yeah, we work with a good number of US cities. So feel free to get in touch if you can see an opportunity to collaborate.
Merely having a cycling embassy seems like a quintessentially Dutch thing to have, but we really appreciate you guys coming on to talk to us. I've thoroughly enjoyed both books. I think this new one, it might be my favorite so far. If you guys ever write a third one, we'll have to have you on again. But before we can let you go, we've already asked you this once, but we do ask all of our guests the same final question. If you had the power to change one policy in a city like Louisville, or maybe it's Delft for you guys, what would it be?
Yeah, I think now having worked with a number of US cities through my day job at the Dutch Cycling Embassy, one of the biggest barriers is the definition of success. And unfortunately, a lot of US transportation departments, especially state DOTs, only want to talk about the number of cars moving on a given street. And that's the one and only parameter that they evaluate the success of a street. Fewer cars means a less successful street. And I would implore them to reconsider that, because as we've written about in both our books, there's so many different ways we can define a successful street. And in fact, the idea that more cars equals success is probably not going to be the case in the 21st century city. And we need to look at the number of social connections, the amount of economic activity, all these other things that we ignore just because we see our streets as traffic sewers rather than actual public spaces where people will live, work, and shop. So it's known as leveled service in a lot of these departments of transport. We really need to get past this idea that streets are for moving single occupant vehicles and start talking about making them places for people.
As for me, I would love for cities everywhere to start applying more gender equitable policies. So really looking at how do we make cities better for both genders and inherently for all genders, because we are now taking into account the experience of women, which becomes the experience of children, the experience of the elderly, and everyone in between. So any cities that can start building more gender equity into their policy and making sure that they're taking a more diverse lens to their projects is doing something good in my books.
Yeah, absolutely. I think both of you all made some incredible points.
Yeah, that last question, I always love the responses, and this time's no different. I really appreciate your all's input. And again, I appreciate you guys coming on and talk to us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us again.
We'll pick back up with our reaction segment after a word from our sponsor.
That was another interesting episode. This time was our second interview with Melissa and Chris Bruntlett. Again, I think they are rock stars just because they have just such a wealth of knowledge that, you know, we try and get guests that know a lot about particular industries, but they, I think, are cream of the crop when it comes to that, because when we're talking about cycling, the statistics, just the sheer knowledge they have is very impressive. What'd you think about the episode?
Well, to be a couple that's now published two books in a pretty brief period of time while dealing with a move and raising two kids, it's definitely an impressive couple. I don't think I could do it, but I was really excited to get my hands on the second book. I enjoyed the first one, and I think the way they described this one, what set it apart, their initial book was kind of talking about how cities can implement these changes to try and make their layouts more accessible, more walk friendly, more bike friendly. And now they're making the argument as to why those changes need to happen. And they're not just making this argument in their book, which was phenomenal. They're making this argument in cities all across the world. I mean, they're going on tours. They're talking about this stuff. They're really educating people, and I love it.
Well, and I think that's the crux of our podcast too, right? Is that we're a policy podcast. You can't just have a policy of how you're going to do something or why something's important. You have to have both. And now they've kind of come full circle and put those pieces together. Now, I'm sure they've missed some, you know, of maybe the drawbacks, right, of having cycling cities. But what they've done is they've put together a comprehensive argument for why cities need to go that way. And I think it's a successful argument.
In reading through this book, there were so many issues brought to light that I wouldn't have considered, you know, it wouldn't be common sense. But as soon as you read it, as soon as it's made apparent, you go, yeah, that makes sense. Why isn't this implemented? Why don't we have more walkable cities? Why don't we have more bike-friendly cities across the U.S., especially here in Louisville, man? We can do it. We got a lot of lanes. We just need to make connections. We need to retrofit some infrastructure, and I think the city as a whole would benefit from it.
Well, and so before we dive in again to, like, some of their answers, some of their conversations, like, let's figure it out. What are the two – like, what are, like, the positives of cars, like, compared to having a more cycling-dense – you know, transit pedestrian friendly city?
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a benefit, but you and I were talking before we got on here about the actual layout of America, how vast the country is as a whole, like geographically. And in a city situation, it's maybe mm-hmm. less the case. But when you talk about rural communities, access to resources, the ability to get out of your small town to be able to get to the cities, to be able to get where you need to go. Cars, I think, in America are always going to be a necessary evil just because of the geography. But when you talk about getting around a city, once you've crossed into that boundary, it should become less of a necessity and something that we can plan around, something that we can legislate and design around.
Yeah, no, I think that is the reason why cars will probably never go away fully in America.
Yeah.
Because, you know, with rural, like, I mean, take for Appalachia, for example, until the federal highway system came in, you know, no one in Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, like, could really get out to the rest of the state. Like, they were almost like stuck there.
Oh, it was very much segregated. You know, that's why that culture is so unique, because mm-hmm. for so many years they were kind of set apart into the hollers, like into the mountain regions, you know, working in the coal fields and in coal towns, you know, with a very, very insular cultural mindset. But we do need to think about the connectivity and the access. We don't want to maintain segregated communities. We want people across the nation to be connected if they want to be.
Yeah, and I think that's where they played the pivotal role. But it's the balance of trying to blend that into these more urban environments and seeing how you can connect them together and how they can work efficiently. And then I think the other aspect of it, too, is if you want to have more bike and pedestrian-friendly towns, you have to have density. And I don't think you can have those two go you can have this conversation without talking about the other. They go hand in hand. And so, you know, I think one item is with more density, you have fewer single family homes. So in theory, I guess, I don't know if it's in practicality, but there's probably less privacy. You don't have as much land. Like, people have less opportunity to have land for their own individual private lifestyles. But that is so minor compared to I lean more towards the accessibility as being like a legitimate concern, but I think both of these are maybe the pro car argument. And then the litany that they give as far as the pro pedestrian, pro bicycle, pro density is just so overwhelming.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked on the podcast before about sprawl being kind of the state of things, like, throughout the last several decades. And there's been pushback on this lately. But as American cities have grown, they have sprawled to, especially the issue case here would be Louisville has spread to the boundaries of Jefferson County
and beyond.
And beyond. Yeah, we really have. We spread into Oldham County. We spread, like, across the boundary lines at that point. And being able to access all parts of the city, all of the necessary parts you would want access to, does currently require a car. You're not going to bike from the county edge to the city center. It's honestly impractical. Mm-hmm. And the only way to alleviate the issues that presents is to increase density in a couple areas where we're going to need to increase the density around downtown, like maybe St. Matt's, you know, places that a lot of people already live, but like we could grow them up rather than sprawling out.
Mm-hmm. Well, eventually that becomes inevitable, right? Yeah. People becomes too far away from jobs, from opportunities, from just even the places they want to go, that people are going to want to live in a more dense area. Yeah. And so I think that comes back to this whole idea of the Bruntlett's putting together this argument of why you want more bike friendly and more pedestrian friendly cities, is because when you start having density and you start putting together, you know, the ability to not necessarily need a car, you know, having more money for other means, the ability just to get what goods you need close by, or being able to feel safe to raise children because they can have a little more independence. When you see these arguments for having a dense city, you have to start implementing the policies that they're suggesting of putting in like segregated bike lanes, widening sidewalks, so that you can actually encourage a denser environment. You can't do one without the other.
Yeah, no, they play off of each other. And I actually want to get back to that kind of independent child argument that you just brought up and that we talked about with the Bruntlett. That was one of the first things that stood out to me in the book. It's something that we have kind of gotten away from a little bit here in America. I think kids kind of have like the helicopter parents a little bit, or that it's at least how it's spoken of. You know, a lot of parents, especially my dad, would kind of talk about just like getting home from school, finishing his homework, and then just like leaving, just like going to hang out with all the kids in the neighborhood and do things like that. And I definitely experienced that to some degree when I was a kid, but it was, the connection is a little bit higher. You kind of have, you got the phone in the pocket, parents are kind of always like a phone call away, and just being able to kind of let your kid out and let them roam around the city on their bike, that seems kind of like a reversion to a norm that I think is kind of idyllic. You know, I would like to be able to trust my kid to just go down to the store, like cycle down to the store, walk down to the store, and not worry about them getting smacked by a car or something, you know, or just knowing that I can trust my kid to get around the city. And honestly, that feeds kind of into the navigation part of it. Like, yeah. I think we've gotten away some bit when we're driving in our cars using GPSs. I personally remember a time prior to GPS when I was first driving, and I felt like I knew the city like the back of my hand. And now if I need to go somewhere that I'm not familiar with, that is not the case. Like, I'm not downloading something off of MapQuest and like actually looking at how it's gonna happen. It's coming at me like turn by turn on my GPS, like from my phone. If I was cycling, and when I do cycle, which is probably less frequent than it needs to be, but when I do cycle, you feel much more connected to the city. You take note of street signs. You actually understand the layout of the neighborhoods that you're cruising through, and you start to form this kind of mental map, you know, that you do not really do anymore in cars with GPS.
Now, you could say you probably could have an attachment to put, you know, your phone on your bike so that you could get a turn by turn direction.
No, you will certainly probably still need GPS if you're going far enough, but there's something about the pace at which you're approaching these turns and the ability to view your surroundings. It feels more leisurely, and you kind of take note of your surroundings in a way that you might not in cars.
Right.
You can imagine like stopping and having a conversation with somebody in a bike. Like, that would never happen in a car.
Yeah, less likely. Yeah.
Yeah. The only conversations happening in cars are probably hostile ones.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I think comes up a lot, which I think just goes back to like quality of life, is the noise pollution. I mean, I live next to train tracks, an airport, and a highway, all three. And it's like, I feel like if I don't want to necessarily start walking in those noise polluted areas, like if I sit on my porch, I have to wait for airplanes to pass sometimes before I can continue a conversation. I think some of our listeners probably could hear airplanes. Doesn't mean I don't live in an unbelievable neighborhood, but the noise pollution from constant highways and things, it can be a drag. And there's, you know, concerns that can hurt, you know, wildlife, you know, potential bird populations can go down from too much noise pollution. So there's a lot of danger in that aspect as well.
It's easy to imagine the drain or the stress that would put on native animal species, them having to account for humans, taking their habitat, but then making it this noisy, bright, very aggressive and hostile environment. You know, it's tough to see or to say without looking at the stats, but you know that can't be good for them.
I agree.
On top of that, I don't know that it's good for humans. Like the noise pollution, as it was noted in the interview, like there's all kinds of research coming out now and in recent years that indicates that it can increase stress. It can be a real strain on humans' bodies and their mental state. That's why getting out, like I love to go camping, and there's obviously it's refreshing to be out in the environment, walking through the woods, seeing like a nice mountain view. I love that. But there is just this kind of inexplicable serenity to being in a really calm state where there isn't a bunch of car traffic going around. There aren't airplanes flying overhead for the most part, or if they are, they're so high up, you don't notice it. It's great.
Well, and I think that's this, you know, goes into more of just the health aspect of this whole idea is like, you know, when we were talking about accessibility earlier, you know, they literally have a chapter that discusses the aging population and how they have more accessibility simply because of a cycling, because you are more ingrained into the cycling. You probably have better fitness, probably have more agility longer term because you're in an environment which encourages you to be active, right?
Absolutely.
And so that also then twofold helps with accessibility, because you're able to walk and communicate into the city for a lot longer period of time. And so I think if there's a health benefit to this, there's an economic driver to this. There's so many factors that I don't know how American cities haven't tried to incorporate more of that. And you're seeing towns in Europe now shutting down major streets to cars completely, just ending them to say, this is going to be a people street. Like, this is going to be for the people. We're going to allow restaurants to take over. We're going to maybe do festivals or, you know, you can have pedestrians, you can have bikes go down it. And they're doing that because they're recognizing that's what people want. They want to enjoy these public spaces.
And there are many examples of cities undertaking projects like that and it really creating an economic driver in their city or like in a specific area of the city. Wherever they've adopted policies like that, I feel like the businesses along streets that are maintained in a walkable or bikeable state, they tend to thrive, you know? And that's the obvious economic benefit. When we talk about like increased ridership, like cycling, we're talking about like increasing fitness in a city. And again, I think it's kind of unrealistic to think that like Louisville is going to replicate Delft in like the number of riders we have. It's not reasonable in the current like city scheme. Like we've talked about the sprawl, there's a million reasons why it would be tough, but even if we could increase it a little bit, you're going to have more people that are engaging in healthy activities. It's going to, you know, cut weight, it's going to help them live a more active lifestyle, and there's going to be that added economic benefit on the back end of just having a healthier population.
Well, and I think the one thing that I always go back to, you know, when we had Gil Holland on in our first season to talk about community development, one thing that he brought up that it really resonated with me was that if you're ever going to do some sort of actual public transportation project, you need to make it permanent. So that's why having, you know, light rail is better than having bus lanes because it's permanent. And so if you're going to put in bike lanes, they need to be segregated. They need to have actual concrete dividers so that it's more permanent. And so the business owners that are choosing to locate near those know that they have some sort of stability, right? So I think there's just a holistic view that we have to take when we're looking at this.
And I mean, when you talk about retrofitting a road to maybe narrow it, widen the sidewalk, adding bike lanes, things like that, that gives the city an opportunity to incorporate more environmentally friendly policies with regard to water runoff and sewage, all kinds of other utilities the city might provide. It gives them an opportunity to access utilities and things like that that otherwise they're not going to undertake, like a massive project like that. But if it's if it's in cooperation with another goal, when you're actually, when your main goal is increasing the walkability or cycling aspect of the city, and then you've got this added benefit of like making it more green, making it more environmentally friendly, it's something that just kind of works together. And I don't know, it's just adding to the benefit you would get.
No, agreed. And I think that's the whole thing of, you have to also account for the environmental impact, right? You have to account for the environmental impact, because as we're, you know, we talk about how there's pressure on corporations now, there's also pressure on government and individuals. And if the government doesn't make it easier for individuals to choose to go greener, then we're still going to be continue to be in this rut, right? So yeah, like most politicians, most corporations are not going to put the blame on individual consumers, but at a certain point, and I think there's a reason for that, right? Because, well, one, corporations want them to keep buying, but the government wants, you know, the politicians still want to keep getting elected. But if you don't put in the infrastructure that allows people to be greener, it's going to be difficult for the country as a whole to shift into a greener environment, unless you're just going all electric cars and just hoping that we can get enough renewable energy production as it is. And then you have the other end of the spectrum too of, you know, just road maintenance. I mean, how often do you think bike lanes get repaved compared to traditional roads? There's no way that it's close to the same, because I get the weather is the same, but you don't have the same weight and pressure put on the road.
Traffic is completely different.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I see that. And like oil runoff and things like that from cars, you're not going to get that. It seems like a net plus. It seems kind of like a no-brainer. But again, we've got to deal with the reality of like the current state of things in many American cities. Mm-hmm. Louisville's not the only city with sprawl.
Oh, for sure.
It's been the American way for way too long.
It's been the North American way, as they noted, as Bruntlett's noted.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really, it's getting people to understand the challenges that we face and incorporate the changes that they can. To take us in the right direction.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, man. This is, like I said, this has been another great interview. I always love talking to them. Do you have anything else before we wrap up?
One last time, you guys need to pick it up. The book is Curbing Traffic, The Human Case for Fewer Cars in Our Lives.
Yeah, and if you didn't read the first one, pick up Building the Cycling City, The Dutch Blueprint for Urban Vitality, both of which are written by Melissa and Chris Bruntlett.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate it, as always. Until next time.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in.
As always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on Building This Community. If you'd like any more information, you can follow us on Twitter at buildingthiscom.com, or you can follow Andrew
at Andrew J. Klump, and you can also follow Luke
at LMP43. Definitely subscribe, and we look forward to talking to you guys next week.